I'm Terry Gross, and this is the hard-boiled edition of Fresh Air. Everyone on today's show has a detective alter ego, except me. It's the weekly archive edition of Fresh Air, and we go back to 1989 for our first interview with one of the best-known writers in the genre, Mickey Spillane, creator of tough guy detective Mike Hammer. Spillane wrote his first Mike Hammer novel in 1947. I, the Jury, was followed by 11 other Hammer stories, including Vengeance is Mine, The Big Kill, and Kiss Me Deadly. Mike Hammer has also had a life in movies and on TV. In 1989, at the age of 71, Spillane revived Hammer in a novel called The Killing Man. Our interview starts with a reading from the first Mike Hammer novel, I, the Jury.
When I looked up, Pat was staring at me strangely. He shook his head. I knew what he was thinking. Mike, lay off. For God's sake, don't go half-cocked about this. I know you too well. You'll start shooting up anyone connected with this and getting a jam you'll never get out of. I'm over it now, Pat. Don't get excited. From now on, I'm after one thing, the killer. You're a cop, Pat. You're tied down by rules and regulations. There's someone over you. I'm alone. I can slap someone in the puss and they can't do a damn thing. No one can kick me out of my job. Maybe there's no way to put up a huge fuss if I get gunned down. But then I still have a private cop's license with the privilege of pack a rod and they're afraid of me. I hate hard, Pat. When I latch onto the one behind this, they're going to wish they hadn't started it. Someday, before long, I'm going to have my rod and my mitt and the killer in front of me. I'm going to watch the killer's face. I'm going to plunk one right in his gut when he's dying on the floor. I may kick his teeth out. You couldn't do that. You have to follow a book because you're a captain of homicide. Maybe the killer will wind up in a chair. You'd be satisfied, but I wouldn't. It's too easy. That killer is going down like Jack did.
Well, I think this sets up the character pretty well. And that whole sense of, and when he's dying on the floor, I may kick his teeth out.
Yeah. How about that?
So, I mean, what does that say about the character? I mean, what did you want to get in there?
Well, the character, something terrible has been done to Mike. His best friend has been shot. Not only shot, but has been shot in a horrible way because the killer wanted to see that guy hurt. Because shot him where it wasn't a death-dealing blow with that shot. He shot him in the gut. He's going to live a while. He's going to be in terrible pain. And that's the way that killer's going to die. So this is the premise of the whole story, that killer's going down just like Jack did, his friend did. And that's what happens.
And Mike Hammer says that in the end, the people have their justice. They get it through guys like me once in a while. You've made Hammer into the guy who's going to get justice outside of the law.
That's right. In this case, he's acting as an arm of the law, but in a different way. He can do things that nobody else can do. He's got more reason for doing it. He's not hung up by rules and regulations the way the cop was. And it's a case of personal vendetta on his part. See, I never had Mike Hammer ever taking a case for money. Everything he ever got into was because of a personal motivation. Something happened to somebody he liked, somebody he loved, some situations were terrible, and he got into it, and with no money behind it. He was on his own all the way because this was a personal nature with him, and he needed all of his attention.
Hammer seems to take a lot of, almost pleasure in vengeance and in returning pain that's been received. Is it cathartic for you to write that way?
No, I never used that particular idea. When you're going into a tough situation, pain's going to be there. You don't want to dwell on these things. But there are certain episodes that require this type of thing. If you want to see pain, violence, sex, you read your newspapers. There's plenty of it there. We have to bring it in where it belongs in the book in order to make the book interesting. You just can't write all about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain rhythm. I mean, in some ways, I think you're really at your best when you're writing violent scenes. There's a certain rhythm that you get in those
scenes.
Yeah,
you can get mad when you write. I punch holes in my paper. The yo's make holes. The periods go right into the platen of the machine. I break up typewriters so fast. And when I'm done with a story, that machine has to go in for repair. So you know what I'd do to it if I ever work with a word processor, tear it apart.
At the end of I, the Jury.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is like perhaps your most famous scene?
Well, this is the one that's so well remembered. This is the one I told you about. They said it was a sensual scene. I see, Mike, he's got a premise in his life. He is going to kill the person who killed his friend in the same way by shooting him in the gut. Now, at the end of the story there, when he's face down with this woman that he loves, Charlotte, She knows what he wants to do. She has to get him away from this attitude. She starts to unrobe. She takes her clothes off piece by piece. And the description is of her getting down to the point where she's nude. And then she leans over while she's about to kiss him. She's really reaching for a gun behind his head. Now, if he's true to his premise, he'll stay alive. If he's not true to it, she's going to kill him. And, of course, what he does, he stays true. He shoots her right in the gut. Now, she's a psychiatrist. She couldn't understand that. And she says, "How could you?" And he says, "It was easy." And that's the way he was. That was the end of the story.
And that's your most famous line, I think, that
oh,
it was
yeah,
easy.
Oh, yeah, it was easy.
Was it considered very unusual to have the private eye kill a woman at the end of a book?
Well, they didn't used to do it in those days. Women were sort of held up on a pedestal. I knocked this one off. I've only killed, I think, two women. Made them villains in any of my stories, but they were effective.
Now, why is that something you wanted to topple in your story?
Women can be as deadly as men any time. Again, you know, just refer back to your newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun doing it to them. Of course, there are other times when women are treated with much more consideration than that.
Were there any limits, editorial limits, censorship limits, to how much sex and violence you could use in the book and still be mass marketed? Were you always cognizant of what your limits were?
Well, the editors do funny things. And when I wrote One Lonely Night, Mike Hammer killed off 200 people with a machine gun, kept reloading and shooting. He was in a commie nest, a real deadly area, and he shot 200 people. And the editor says, "Oh, that's much too much, too much blood." So he knocked it down to 100 people.
That was supposed to be a big change.
That's your editorial concept.
In your novels, women lick their luscious lips seductively a lot.
Yeah.
I know I'm a woman and not a man, but I've really never seen a woman lick her lips.
Well, you never were watching.
Perhaps. As I say,
that's a little game they play, you know.
Have you seen that a lot? Because, I remember.
Sure, I've seen it many times. The French said they make a moo, M-O-U-E, you know,
Mickey Spillane is my guest, and he's written his first Mike Hammer novel in 19 years. I read that you were actually with the police on the bust of a narcotics ring.
Oh, I was on several of those big ones, yeah.
But that you took two bullets on one of them.
Well, I got one. Uh-huh. That was enough. Well, it was one shot, but it was a buckshot in the darn thing. Whenever you go out playing around, you're going to get hurt. So the best thing to do, don't go where trouble happens. Otherwise, you're going to be part of it, and then you can get clobbered. I'm not about looking for any of these things anymore. I'll use everything that's in my mind. I will use my imagination. I'll get into fiction and keep it that way. I don't want any more realism. That gets to be rough.
Well, this is a kind of weird question, but when you actually were shot, I don't know if this is too weird or not, but how did it compare with how you imagined it was when you had characters being shot in your books?
Well, it was a little bit screwy because I was standing behind a whole bunch of tomato paste. There was a slogan for this tomato paste: "Who put those six big tomatoes in the itty-bitty cans?" And the bullet went through the cans, got everybody splashed with tomato paste, and everybody thought they had all been shot as well.
Oh, gee.
So the shot just sprayed around, and it was...
How bizarre. Since you had tomato sauce all over, were you able to figure out right away where the actual wound was?
Yeah, you'll know right where that is.
Right,
but
okay.
You're not considering that right away. Go, as everybody got clobbered, and that was, it was kind of hard to get the tomato sauce off, though. It wasn't deadly, I'll tell you that.
So is the sensation something that you've recalled for writing?
No. You're better off if you use your imagination. Writing is something completely different. When you're writing fiction, it's easy. You can do things with fiction that nobody ever believed in. Words are great. They're expressive. You can say things that you'd never experience and make them sound real. Hey, that's what being a writer is all about. I have as much fun writing as I do have reading.
You've said that the first part of a story that comes to you is the ending, because that's where you have to get to, and that's in your novels the dramatic climax. Seems to me your titles come from the last page, too.
Not always. No. When you're writing, see, it's like a joke. The only part of a joke you listen to is that punchline. So when you develop a story, that's your important part, is the big ending on there. Now, O. Henry did this in all of his stuff, and he was an old-time writer. I've just gone ahead and elaborated on his style a little bit in the structure of a story. Titles come out of the air. I don't know where they come from, but when I was doing The Killing Man, we couldn't get a title for that. And we were writing down all sorts of titles. We put them on the computers looking for any duplications and whatnot. And I was sitting there, all of a sudden I looked at it, I said, The Killing Man, that's it. And it just popped into my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't try for a title until after the book is finished.
Something I recently learned about you is that you are, or were, I'm not sure which, a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, I've been a Jehovah's Witness since 1951.
You know, what surprised me about that was that I know you're not your character, but, I mean, Hammer is such the man alone that it seemed, like, hard for me to fathom that you were, you know, part of an organized religion.
Well, I'm not going to discuss it with you now, but next time one of Jehovah's Witnesses is knocking on the door, call them in. They'll tell you all about it. But religion's a strange thing, you know. It's something you have personally in your lives, and you got to believe in it, and I believe in what I believe in.
Can I ask if
sure.
if the witnesses have ever objected to your books?
No. I don't think they read them, and I don't blame them. But when you're writing, it's just this is a job with me. I don't write for any express purpose like passing messages around. It's strictly a job. I try to keep them fairly contemporary and fairly clean. The first time I used a four-letter word in a book, I thought the publishers were going to go out of their minds, and this was a long time after it was coming out in other books. I don't try to use bad language, mainly because these are, again, our exclamation points within the story. And I try to keep things as normal as possible. Anybody wants to read Violence and Sex, go to the newspaper. There's plenty of it there.
Something else I recently learned about you is that you collect blue willow pottery.
Yeah.
Which is a surprising hobby for a hard-boiled guy.
Well, it's not a one-time blue willow was just cheap kitchenware for all the farm ladies all over the country. It was made by different companies, but there was a classic thing about it. It was all excellently made. It was great chinaware. Cheap, very cheap. But now it's up on the stage where, you know, it becomes antique and looks nice. And I lost a whole mess of it down in the hurricane.
Yeah.
And my wife collects pewterware, and she lost her pewterware. But we'll get it back. There's a lot of it out there, and the fun is going out collecting these things and doing it again. And I like it. It's useful. It's pretty looking. And it reminds me of my childhood, because we had it at home.
Well, speaking of your childhood, your father was a bartender?
Yeah, he was a good Irish bartender in Brooklyn.
So, did you hang out at that bar?
No, I would never hang out at a bar because I don't like the atmosphere of a bar. It's nobody goes into a bar to get sober, and again, it's a trouble spot. Bar scenes where you have restaurants. Well, this is a different situation. But when you speak of a bar, you know, you're speaking of like a neighborhood pub type of bar where everybody's in there and they finally. It's a place where they go and they don't want to go home. But I don't hang around in those places. Mm-hmm. I never did.
Mickey Spillane, thanks a lot for talking with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Mickey Spillane recorded in 1989. We'll be right back with detective writer Lawrence Block after this break. This is Fresh Air. Lawrence Block has a new novel featuring his private eye, Matt Scudder. Block has written over 10 Scudder novels. Scudder's turf is Manhattan. Scudder is a former cop who quit the force after he accidentally shot and killed a teenager. He left his wife, two kids, and home in the suburbs, and now lives alone in a small, dingy hotel room. Of the Lawrence Block novels I've read, my favorite is 8 Million Ways to Die, which was published in 1982. This moody novel was a turning point for Detective Scudder. After years of hard drinking, he tried staying sober and joined AA. It wasn't easy for this cynical loner to feel at home in a support group. In 1992, we asked Lawrence Block to read an excerpt.
I got to the meeting a couple of minutes early. Half a dozen people said hello to me by name. I got some coffee and sat down. The speaker told an abbreviated drinking story and spent most of the time telling of all the things that had happened to him since he got sober 4 years ago. His marriage had broken up, his youngest son had been killed by a hit-and-run driver, he'd gone through a period of extended unemployment and several bad bouts of clinical depression. I wanted to leave at the break. Instead, I got a cup of coffee and took a couple of Fig Newtons. I ate the cookies. It was like chewing straw, but I chewed them and washed them down. During the discussion, one woman got into a long riff about her relationship. She was a pain in the ass. She said the same thing every night. I tuned out. I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic. A woman I know got killed last night. She hired me to keep her from getting killed, and I wound up assuring her that she was safe and she believed me. And her killer conned me, and I believed him, and she's dead now, and there's nothing I can do about it. And it eats at me, and I don't know what to do about that, and there's a bar on every corner and a liquor store on every block. And drinking won't bring her back to life, but neither will staying sober. And why the hell do I have to go through this? Why? I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and we sit around in these goddamned rooms and say the same damn things all the time, and meanwhile out there all the animals are killing each other. We say don't drink and go to meetings, and we say the important thing is you're sober, and we say easy does it, and we say one day at a time, and while we natter on like brainwashed zombies, the world is coming to an end. I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and I need help. When they got to me, I said, my name is Matt. Thanks for your qualification. I enjoyed it. I think I'll just listen tonight.
Lawrence Block, thanks for reading that passage from 8 Million Ways to Die. You know, having your main character, Matthew Scudder, having given up alcohol creates this intense mood of constant craving for what he can't have. And in 8 Million Ways to Die, life is kind of drained of color and meaning during these periods when he's really craving alcohol. I guess what got you thinking about how you could use that in the novel?
Well, the Matthew Scudder series of books evolved gradually. 8 Million Ways to Die was the fifth book in the series. And in the first three books, he's a hard drinker who doesn't really pay much mind to the effects or implications of his drinking. And when I started writing the books, I fully intended that he would stay like that forever. Most series detectives certainly are static characters. They don't change much. That's always been the case. And I found as the series progressed, the fourth book was called A Stab in the Dark, and in that one he's beginning to see that there's something pathological about his drinking but doesn't really want to look at it. And in 8 Million Ways to Die, that was a pivotal book in which his struggles with his alcoholism and his being forced to come to terms with that are really as much a part of the book as is the solution of a crime.
I find it interesting, you know, that you've taken this character who loves hanging out at bars, and a lot of his sources are at bars, and he even goes to bars after joining AA because that's kind of where he lives. I wonder, well, I should ask you first if you had a problem with alcohol and if you had to give it up and if you're writing out of a first-person knowledge about some of these things.
Well, I don't like to talk about that too much, but I will say that I used to drink rather the way Scudder did, and I don't drink anymore.
Do you still hang out in bars? I mean, is there something about bars that you like very much, in spite of the fact that you can partake of the alcohol?
No, not particularly. My own experience is that bar conversation that may have seemed fascinating and stimulating years ago seemed to require a fairly high blood level of alcohol in order to be all that absorbing.
So why does your character keep going back?
Well, he there's only really one bar that he hangs out at a lot, and that's because of a particular relationship he has with a fellow he met. Yeah, I should probably say that I thought the books were going to end with 8 Million Ways to Die. That seemed to be a catharsis in the character's life, and I thought, gee, there's no place to go after this. His detra has lost its raison. You know, he's still a detective, but you know, let him go get a life on his own time. But it turned out that I liked the character a lot. I liked seeing the world through those particular eyes and all and. And I did write further books about it. The 10th is called A Walk Among the Tombstones.
Writer Lawrence Block is my guest. Let me get back to 8 Million Ways to Die.
Sure.
Again for a second. You know, the main character keeps reading the New York Daily News, and every day there's another really gruesome murder that's taken place that's in the headlines. And that's where the title 8 Million Ways to Die comes
from. Right.
Because for each person in New York, there's another way of possibly... Mm-hmm. being murdered or killed. Are you... What's your reaction when you read that stuff in the paper?
Well, it was interesting, and that particular book, when I was writing that, I was living up in Washington Heights at that particular time, and I would do my day's work, and then I would leave the house generally late afternoon, pick up a copy of the news, and get on the subway and ride downtown. And the horrible stories that Scudder dutifully reports each time were the ones that I'd read the night before and that I then would write about. You know, the city never failed to provide heinous atrocities for me to report in the next day's writing. It was quite bizarre.
A lot of despair in a lot of crime fiction, in part because the detective is often lonely and is exposed to the most brutal aspects of society. And I'd say probably not so much in the more recent stuff, but, you know, Scudder has dealt with his share of despair. There must be something about that kind of mood that you personally respond to.
Oh, sure. I don't always walk along humming, you know, but I think this is a hard world, and most people have a great deal of grief in their lives, you know, and I don't feel it's my mission solely to reflect that in my work, and a lot of my work is quite lighthearted. Certainly there's a series of books I did about a burglar named Bernie Rodenbaugh, which they're also set in New York, and it's a different New York from the one that Scudder lives in. The streets are the same, but the feel is different.
Does it ever feel odd to you that the character you've created is always having these life-endangering adventures while you're almost always sitting home and typing?
Well, no, I haven't thought about that much. I suppose in certain respects, Scudder's life is more interesting and dramatic than mine, but otherwise he'd be sitting around writing about me.
Lawrence Block, recorded last year. Lawrence Block's new Matt Scudder novel is called The Devil Knows You're Dead. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.